Good afternoon, and thank you for tuning in to Faith and Reason here on Holy Family Radio. This is your host, Dr. John Pinero, and I'm happy today to have Professor Jay Bujyczewski back on the program. We talked to him a while ago, and he has a new book out, a commentary on Thomas Aquinas' Treatise on Law, published by Cambridge University Press, well, in 2014. I still call my book new, and it's got a 2014 copyright, so... Now, Professor Bujyczewski specializes in political philosophy and ethical philosophy and the interaction of religion with philosophy. And he's done quite a bit of research into natural law and virtue ethics and moral self-deception, which is one of the topics we discussed last time we had him on the program. You can find out information about all his works and also get access to his blog and how to find out about the commentary, his newest book, at undergroundthomas.org, www.undergroundthomas.org. Professor Bujyczewski, welcome to Faith and Reason.
Hi, I'm glad to be with you.
Thank you very much. Now, I was in preparing for our discussion today, I was reading up on Thomas Aquinas in law, and I do a little bit with this even in American history because I assign Martin Luther King's letter from a Birmingham jail to the students.
Yeah,
and you know, in there he talks about Thomas Aquinas, and I like pointing this out to our students because, well, King is a Protestant minister living in the 20th century, and Thomas Aquinas, of course, was a Dominican from the 13th and 12th century. And of course, my college is named Aquinas, and I want them to see the link, right? One of the things King talks about is how we discover what is a just law and what is an unjust law. And I thought that might be a good way to open the program. We have a lot of listeners, and maybe ourselves, there's laws we would protest against, maybe legalized abortion, for instance. There's certain laws we might break because we're lazy, like speed limits and that kind of thing. And then there's laws we most of us would not break no matter what. But how do we make that decision? You know, who are we to judge the laws of the land and say this is just, this is not unjust, so therefore I can break this one or I shouldn't break this one? How do we get to that point?
Well, there's a difference in the first place between just a law, let's say, that's not very good and a law that's actually unjust. The legislators might have had the intention of justice. They might have intended the promotion of the common good, but just been inept, for instance, and passed a law which is, you know, pretty good but could have been better. That doesn't make the law unjust. An unjust law is going to be, well, first of all, Thomas Aquinas says a law can be unjust either because it's contrary to our temporal good, our well-being in this life, or it can be unjust because it's contrary to the integrity of our eternal good, of our relationship with God. If it's unjust in the second way, well, it just has to be disobeyed. Just has to be disobeyed. If God commands you something like "do not murder," and the human law says, "Well, here are some people you just have to murder," then you're going to have to disobey, even if the state takes your life. On the other hand, if the law is unjust in the other way, it isn't contrary to the laws of God, but it is contrary to your well-being in this life. Well, what could that mean? It might mean that it's unjust with respect to who made it. The people who made it didn't have any business making it. For instance, even the church cannot baptize children against the will of the parents. Now that's a matter of canon law, but the same would apply to the state. There are some things that the state doesn't have any authority to do. There are some things that particular agencies of the state don't have any authority to do. The legislature can do certain things, the executive can do others, and so forth. So the first way a law can be unjust is that somebody's doing something and he doesn't have any authority to do it. The second way that it can be unjust in the temporal sense is that it's contrary to the common good. Somebody is just passing what he calls a law, and he's really just trying to promote the well-being of his cronies, not the well-being of everyone. And then the third way is that the law can be Thomas Aquinas is unjust with respect to his form. What he means is that it violates the fundamental principle of justice, that you do to people what is due to them. You know, you give reward to people who've done well, you give punishment to people who've done evil. What if, for instance, you gave all the civil service to the least qualified people? And that would be unjust in this formal sense. So when a law is unjust in these ways, Thomas Aquinas says, well, you may disobey it, although there may be cases where the harm of disobeying it turns out to be even greater than the harm of the injustice of the law itself. What if people rioted or were led into by your violation of the law into wrongdoing because they thought, well, I can just be a lawmaker now, and they were even violating just laws. But anyway, the bottom line is that unjust laws are different than just bad laws. That laws that are unjust because they're contrary to the well-being of your relationship with God have to be disobeyed. Laws that are unjust in other ways may be disobeyed, except in those cases where the harm that might come from disobedience is even greater.
So I wonder which category is larger in the United States between, that is, those laws that are contrary to God's eternal law and our final end in God, those that are unjust in terms of the common good and violating principles of justice, etc. And then just, I'll use the word stupid laws. You're very nice to say bad laws. But I've lived in several states as an academic. We're sort of nomadic, unfortunately, in lots of cases. And, you know, one of my favorites was the snack tax in California in the 1990s. And it was an effort by lawmakers and by the then Governor Pete Wilson to try to discern what counted as a food that would be a necessity and what would be a snack, because while California won't tax food because it's a necessity, when does something become a snack? So they, you know, went through lists of fruits and vegetables, and some kinds of chips ended up being a snack and some kind of chips didn't. And of course, I imagine this worked out a little bit like, the East India Tea Company bribing Parliament in the 1760s and, you know, to help them. We know how that ended up. And this, I think that even in California, that was a tax. It was repealed at some point. And I don't know that it was unjust, but it was stupid.
You suggest something really interesting just now when you talked about the tea companies. A law that is just stupid and not unjust can sometimes create an opening for actual injustice, because it's so badly drawn that it provides incentives for people to start wheeling and dealing and bribing the lawmakers for special advantages and so forth. Then you've got real injustice.
Okay, that's very, very interesting. So with the complexity of laws we have now, then this is maybe at the root of when someone says, my voice can't be heard. Laws in Congress are so complex, so much is shoehorned in, and even at the various state capitals, that it's hard to really know what these laws mean. And then some Congressmen and women will say, I don't know what's in it. I'll read it after I vote for it.
That produces another problem. Thomas Aquinas says that a law, anything that really deserves the name law, has to have four elements. It has to have these four elements, or it's not something that, he says, can bind us in conscience. In other words, that can actually generate a duty to obey it. So a law has to be an ordinance of reason. That means it has to be something the mind can recognize as right. It has to be for the common good. That means it's not for some special interest. It has to be made by competent authority. There's no such thing as a private law, for instance. In the sense that I can't make a law for everybody else as a private individual.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to be promulgated. That means it has to be made known. There's no such thing as a secret law. Now, when laws are excessively complex so that nobody can understand them, even somebody might say, well, we promulgated that law. You know, we published it in the Code of Federal Regulations and so forth. It's right there. You can read it in the Library of Congress. Yes, but if it's so complicated that nobody can understand it, can you really honestly be said to have properly promulgated it, to have made it known? I don't think that you have. And it seems to me that such laws are not really laws at all. Thomas Aquinas says, and he's quoting St. Augustine here, that a law which is unjust really shouldn't be called a law at all. It ought to be called an act of violence.
Mm. Now, the world Thomas lived in, and please correct me if I'm wrong, there would have been two codes of justice or of law in whatever realm he was in, right? The canon law, the laws of the church, which would have been governed differently in many cases than the law of the land, let's say.
There might have even been more than that.
Okay.
It was very messy. For instance, we forget that the expression common law that we use in English law originally meant that law which was common to the entire realm. It wasn't just the local baron's law. It was the king's law. So you not only had a difference between the law of the whole land and the law of the church, but you also had the law of the, shall we say, the local land, of your own baron, and it was a very messy situation. This is one of the reasons. There were lots of other reasons too, but why Thomas Aquinas needed to write the treatise on law. He wanted to try to sort all of that out and explain the relationships between the different kinds of law and what the fundamental principles really were, so that you didn't just get lost in the bushes.
And so, what happens when a church law and the king's law or a local law are run counter to each other? And would it be possible for both of those to be just laws? Let's say the church or the local, maybe it's the local baron, is outlawing something that is immoral, but it's in that category that Thomas writes about, where he says you can't outlaw everything, right?
Well, okay. There are some things that that are the business of the church, so to speak, and there are some things that are the business of the state. But if the state takes upon itself to command something that is contrary to the law of God, such a law is unjust and must be disobeyed. Just from the very tail end of your comment, though, just now, mm-hmm. I thought you might be thinking of permissive laws, of laws that if the state allows something. We're not talking about commanding it, but allows something that is actually, by the law of God, sinful.
That's right. Yes, that is what I was thinking.
Yeah. Well, it isn't possible for the human law to make every sin, every vice, every act of vice illegal. It's the fundamental purpose of the human law is the common good, just like the purpose of all law, and it actually doesn't serve the common good to try to suppress every act of vice. Thomas Aquinas says, people may break out into yet greater evils. We have a possible example of that. Some people still argue about it. But we have a possible example of that in the Prohibition era during the history of our own republic. The state thought, well, alcohol is something that can be abused, and so why don't we just make it illegal? And there were some good things that happened. I'm told that admissions to hospitals for alcoholic psychosis went down. Mm-hmm. I'm told that police reports of drunken husbands beating their wives went down. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, you had some evils happening too. People lost respect for the law. They violated it in droves. The fact that that alcohol was still being sold illegally meant enormous black market profits for crooks who then used their profits partly to bribe the police, so it led to official corruption. And the public eventually decided, you know, the evils of trying to suppress this evil are greater than the evil itself. Let's leave it alone. God's law can prohibit everything that is wrong. The law of human beings is much more limited in its scope. It's a blunt instrument, and good theology recognizes that. Now, that doesn't mean that the law can take something fundamentally and intrinsically evil like murder and say, well, you know, it's hard to enforce this, we'll allow it, or abortion, or something of that sort. But we're talking about matters of detail.
Now, when Thomas was writing his treatise, a couple questions about this just to clarify. Is this an early work of Thomas or a later work? I imagine
this is a pretty late work. This was the mature Thomas Aquinas.
Okay.
Yeah, and he
because
also,
I imagine he evolved like the rest of us on reflection and thinking and reworking ideas.
He had been working professionally a long time. The treatise on law is a part of a much, much larger work called the Summa Theologiae. And we call it the treatise on law. That's not what Thomas Aquinas himself called it. It just happens to be a section of the Summa that's about law. A Summa is a summary. It's a comprehensive work that brings together everything that we know about certain things. In this case, everything we know about God and man and about the relationship between them, which is a pretty darn big topic. But he'd even done several summas before. He'd done a commentary on the sentences of Peter Lombard, which was a kind of a summa, and he'd done another summa, the Summa Contra Gentiles, before he even embarked on this one. So this is the mature Thomas. We can trust this as a pretty final expression of his thought.
In the Summa and in the treatise specifically, does he think about other types of government than monarchy? When you say competent authority and you mention prohibition, and I just think of democracy's tendency to degenerate either into demagoguery or to sort of do these passionate, outlandish things that then, on reflection, the people say in the United States it took about 13 years, but the people say, yeah, that was a really bad idea. Look at all the evils that came from this.
He says, and it's in the treatise on law itself, as it so happens, that he thinks that he believes that the best form of government, the one that is best suited to our temporal well-being, is a mixed form of government. It's partly kingship, because there's one person in charge. It's partly aristocracy, because there are other people who are chosen to assist in ruling because of their wisdom. And it's partly democracy, because these wise people are chosen from among the people and chosen by the people. So although it's true that in some passages he says the best form of government is monarchy, that's an example of the figure of speech that is called metonymy. He uses the word kingship sometimes for any good form of government, not just for kingship in the literal sense. And we should understand that he means a mixed form of government. I mean, we have a mixed form of government, right? Thomas Aquinas would say that our president is a king, a sort of an odd kind of king. He rules for a fixed term. He is elected. His office is not hereditary, and our constitutional traditions make him co-equal to the other branches. But Thomas Aquinas would say, well, that's a king. So you've got a monarchical element in your constitution. That's the guy who's in charge of execution. But we also our founders thought that the Senate was a sort of an aristocratic element, and that the House of Representatives was a sort of a weakly democratic element. So our form is mixed.
Yeah, so before the Enlightenment, before Montesquieu, there was Thomas a few hundred years before suggesting this mix.
Yeah, these ideas about mixed forms of government and checks and balances and things, these are not new. The notion of the Roman Republican theorists, for instance, before even Thomas, used to talk about checks and balances all the time. The Roman Republic had so many checks, as a matter of fact, among the different parts of the government, that it was at times difficult for it to even make decisions.
Now, Thomas, of course, was a great lover and propagator of Aristotle and working with Aristotle's thought and Christian thinking. Did Aristotle recommend a mix, or did he put monarchy on top? I'm wondering how much of this comes from Aristotle talking about these three types of government, the few, the many, the one.
Well, it does come from that, but it comes doesn't come straight from Aristotle. It comes from Aristotle with help from, I think, with help from, with influence from some of the later Greek political theorists during Roman times, like Polybius, I believe, who were influenced by Aristotle. Mm-hmm. You know, Aristotle says, well, there are three good forms of government, and he says there's kingship or monarchy, there's aristocracy, and interestingly, then he doesn't say democracy. He considers democracy to be, he uses the word for something like mob rule.
Mm-hmm.
He says the third form of government is a good form of government is a mixture. Usually that's going to be a mixture between aristocracy and between oligarchy and democracy, which is very funny because it means you've got two bad forms of government. you've got power-hungry nobles, and you've got the power-hungry rabble, and each wants to exploit the other, and you balance them off against each other. You can make that work, and that's the least good of the three goods. But the later Roman theorists had said, well, you know, you might have a lower class that's virtuous, so why don't we use the word democracy for that? And a mixed form of government doesn't really belong in this diagram. It belongs off to the side. So we've got these three pure forms, kingship and aristocracy and democracy, and we can talk about mixing them. They were the ones then who said that the best form of government, they were the first ones who said the best form of government was a mixture of those three. Thomas Aquinas agrees with them and gives additional arguments both from philosophy and experience and from scripture too, because he says he thinks that that's what you had under Moses. Because look, Moses is something like a king. His father-in-law Jethro said, Moses, you know, you're just killing yourself trying to do all of this by yourself. You need to have wise men who assist in the work of government. Okay, that's an aristocratic element. Moses agrees these wise men then came from the tribes, and they were chosen by the tribes, their elders and whatnot. So since that, and that's a democratic element because it had the consent of the people. So he says, look, it's scriptural too.
What role do you think the new mendicant religious orders and really the way even the Benedictines were governed in terms of democracy and, you know, having elected leaders, et cetera, did that play any role in Thomas's thinking? It seems to me when I look at the history of some of the religious orders in the Catholic Church, one of the places we do find, I guess, for lack of a better term, you know, kind of the best example of democracy at these points or representative government is usually in some of these religious orders.
Well, yes, you do. I hadn't given much thought to the influence of the internal governance of the mendicant orders on Thomas Aquinas' political thought. And that's an interesting suggestion. I had thought about the influence of the mendicant orders on his thought in another respect.
Mm-hmm.
The natural law thinker Russell Hittinger points out that Thomas Aquinas' defense of the mendicant orders, because they had a lot of critics. There were people who said, well, you know, what is this? You innovators, you mm-hmm. hippies, going off and taking vows of poverty and obedience and wandering all over Europe. you know, you're just a bunch of trouble.
It sounds very apostolic, right? It can only mean trouble.
Yeah, it can only mean trouble. And but Thomas Aquinas emphasized that they had a, to use a word that came into vogue in later centuries, they had a vocation. They had a they had a purpose, they had a function that the social nature of man needs to flourish in a lot of different dimensions, right? But just like we have families and we've got the church as a whole and we've got governments and we've got neighborhoods and so forth, well, here you have to have you need these communities too. They've got something to contribute, something to do. They have a munus, a function or a calling, and this lays some of the groundwork, Hittinger argues, for what we in our time call the principle of subsidiarity, which is that, you know, this is really important because, you know, radical individualists like some libertarians think, well, there's only individuals. Statists and totalitarians of all sorts, and we've got them in the West too, think it's the government is the only thing. So between these two poles, you've got this whopping big government on the top, you've got all these individual people on the bottom. What about all that stuff in between? The principle of subsidiarity says these individuals are people are social. They're organized into many different forms of association, families and so forth. These are important. They all have their own work, and the state should not take over or destroy or absorb or try to govern that work. It should just restrict itself to its own work, which is chiefly helping them, providing the background conditions that they need in order to do their work.
So subsidiarity, such a key principle, it seems to me, particularly in the New Catechism, when we think about economic matters and government and the level of regulation required in a free society, that sort of thing.
I would say it's the best kept secret of Catholic social doctrine. It implies that you don't want to just kick everything upstairs to the government. That if anything can be done at lower levels, then let it be done there. And respecting the fact that the work of that's going on in some of these lower level forms of association is even ordained by natural law. That's really fundamental, and it goes against a reflex of a lot of thinking in our time that says, "Oh, you have a problem? Turn it over to the government."
Mm-hmm. Well, this is Dr. John Pinheiro, and you're tuned into Holy Family Radio. Our show is Faith and Reason, and I'm speaking with Professor Jay Bujiszewski, who is a specialist in, among other things, virtue ethics and natural law, and we've been talking for the last half hour about Thomas Aquinas' treatise on law, and more specifically, what makes a law, what doesn't make a law, and it's been a very wide-ranging conversation thus far. Professor, I'd like to turn now to our determination and how we do it, how we reach that determination where I'm not going to follow a law, or what am I going to do about it, and is, you know, sins against conscience. You mentioned conscience earlier, and ever since, I think since the Second Vatican Council's declaration, Dignitatis Humanae, with the stress coming out of the Second Vatican Council on freedom of conscience, and a much misunderstood thing among Catholics, among non-Catholics, and what freedom of conscience means and doesn't mean. And I thought maybe we could start with Thomas and just ask, you know, what did it mean to Thomas? I know that he had a disagreement, speaking of mendicants, with the Franciscan Saint Bonaventure about what conscience was. I mean, they both knew conscience was this, well, maybe philosophers wouldn't use a term like thing for this, but depending on who they are. But what is conscience to Thomas, and we want to get at how that's going to interact with our discernment about law and that tension between authority and conscience.
Well, let's take, for context, let's take that question and step back a couple of steps and think about what people commonly say today about conscience, which Thomas would disagree with. People today think that conscience is one thing. And they think that one thing has no root in our nature, that it's just pumped in from the outside, that it's arbitrary, that your parents teach you something, and some of it gets into you and sticks, and, you know, the teacher teaches you something, and some of it gets in you and sticks. And the policeman teaches you something, and the minister teaches you something, and so forth. And all those leftover little bits, all those residues of the way you were brought up, the way you were socialized, whatever is still in there, after you've grown up, people say, well, that's your conscience, see? It all just comes from the outside. If your parents brought you up and they told you you ought to kill people who get in your way, then your conscience will tell you that you ought to kill people who get in your way. And if they told you, thou shalt not kill, then your conscience will tell you then that you shouldn't kill. Now, Thomas Aquinas does not agree with that thinking at all. In the first place, he would say that what we want to think of as conscience as one thing is really two things. The thinkers of his day had actually two different terms for them. One was synderesis, which I like to call deep conscience, and the other was conscientia. That's where we get our word conscience from. And I like to think of it as surface conscience or as conscience in action. Synderesis means there is a fundamental, a natural disposition. He calls it a habit, but he uses the word habit a little differently than we do in English. Disposition of the mind to just be aware of certain first principles of moral reasoning. You don't have to be taught, for instance, the Golden Rule. When a child who's never formally been taught the Golden Rule may be told by his mother, don't pull your sister's hair. How would you like it if somebody pulled your hair? Now, why does this make sense to the child? Because he can spontaneously see, he can spontaneously recognize, you know, the truth of the principle that he shouldn't do unto others as he wouldn't want them to do to him. That's the negative form of the Golden Rule. It's just like when we teach a kid 2 + 2 = 4. Sure, you're teaching the child, but how is it even possible to teach the child? The only reason it's possible to teach him is that he can see for himself. When it's pointed, yes, 2 + 2 = 4, isn't it? So there has to be something that is already there prior to teaching, or the teaching nothing to take root in. Now, that's something that is already there. In the case of moral knowledge, is the knowledge of the first principles. I should not gratuitously harm my neighbor, for instance. And this is that by which we know these things, that ability or disposition of the mind to be aware of them, Thomas Aquinas calls synderesis or deep conscience. All right? Now, when you this knowledge is not always, I mean, it's there in us potentially, latently, you might say, but now you have to bring it into action. It's one thing to know in general, I shouldn't gratuitously harm my neighbor. It's pretty easy to work out from that. Thomas Aquinas thinks everybody does it in a flash, that therefore I ought not to murder my neighbor. But now, people will sometimes argue, is this murder? Would this be murder if I'm killing in self-defense, for instance? Would this be an act of stealing? When you actually have to make that concrete act of judgment, that is that action, that actualization of your knowledge, is what he calls conscience. Now, synderesis is natural. It can't be erased. It can't be modified. It's just there. But all of the ways in which we make use of synderesis, the ways that we actualize it, the ways that we bring it to bear on every day to day, case by case judgment, conscience, conscientia, those things can be influenced by teaching. And we can make mistakes there and go wrong. But Thomas Aquinas says that the certain judgment of conscience, the certain judgment of conscience is something that the individual experiences as the voice of God within him. To go against the certain judgment of your conscience is to go against, this is true even if you're mistaken in your judgment, is to go against God as you understand God to be speaking to you. So you must always obey the certain judgment of your conscience. Now, what if the judgment of your conscience is mistaken? Well, then you're in trouble, because it doesn't mean that what you just did, acting on the certain judgment of your conscience, is okay. In order for what you do to be okay, you've got to be acting on your conscience, but you'd also better be darn sure that the judgment of your conscience is correct. So the only solution to that problem is to have a well-formed conscience. We need to discipline ourselves. We need to listen to those who are wiser than we are, and we need to listen to the church, and we need to practice the virtues. So then the judgments of our conscience are going to be correct, and we aren't going to get into trouble following them.
But this ultimately, I mean, then we come back to the question of authority, don't we? That we're going to have an outside authority that helps us form that conscience when we're tackling specific cases.
Yes, there does have to be an authority. Thomas Aquinas says, for instance, look, even things that are self-evident, they may be self-evident in themselves, but they aren't necessarily self-evident to us. I can imagine somebody arguing, "How do I know that?" Two parallel lines will never meet. You drew them on the board and they didn't meet, but maybe if we drew them out in chalk on the sidewalk for a couple of miles, they would meet. That's very silly, but you see, there's a difference between whether it's evident in itself and whether it's evident to us. That can even be true of first principles in the realm of ethics. So we need to listen. We need things to be pointed out to us. There are some things that are obvious to everybody, but then there are other things that only wise people who have reflected on them and had some experience and even they gained from people before them. There's an accumulation of wisdom over the generations. We have to listen to them and have our consciences formed.
So a rightly formed conscience then can never be, this is never just a presentist phenomenon. This kind of, I talk about this in history classes, and you probably do as well, this sense that it's just kind of natural, I think, post-Enlightenment and particularly post, the 20th century and the theory of progress, to look at the growth of humanity as this kind of, growing from childhood to adulthood. And we just know so much more than people who have gone before us. Maybe not in the particulars, and maybe they knew literature better, but by golly, in terms of morality, I might be a 20-year-old college student, or I might be a 50-year-old, but I'm sure I know more than those who've gone before, and I'm just going to disregard what they have to say.
Right. We're not right. This isn't a presentist in that sense. We're not saying, I know better just because I'm me in this time and I can disregard everybody before myself. There is an accumulation of knowledge over the generations. Now, just like anything else in human affairs, that can go wrong. You might have been taught something wrong by your grandparents, by those who purported to be wise before you. But if all goes well, just as an individual learns over the course of his life, the human race ought to be learning and ought to be accumulating knowledge so that we can make better decisions about some things now, wiser than formerly. Look at slavery. It took centuries for us to figure out the fundamental problem with this and to get rid of it. And as a matter of fact, in some parts of the world, we still haven't gotten rid of it, although now it sometimes hides itself under names other than slavery.
It hides itself.
And we can even regress and slip back into other things like abortion. But we should be learning.
So progress really, I mean, it's good to know, progress really is possible, but we're talking about a moral progress to which the past and accumulated wisdom of centuries, the trial and error of past generations, as Russell Kirk used to call it, that's absolutely necessary if we're going to use our prudential judgment in these things. How difficult then is it in a society like today to argue against the sense that conscience is really just – conscience is my desires or it's what I feel? You've probably read an essay like this from a student. I feel that. And you want them to use the word think, and then you want them actually to think, right? And but there's a whole lot of feeling going
this kind of feels
good, right? You know, Janis Joplin's life didn't end well, but, you know, hey, if it feels good, do it.
As a matter of fact, I always tell my students when they're getting ready to write an essay, I don't want to hear you tell me that Aristotle feels something unless he's actually describing his emotions.
Yeah.
And then you can say he feels anger, whatever.
Sure.
But don't say he feels that. All human action is carried out for the sake of some purpose. No, he thinks that. He judges that. He perceives that. This is an intellectual operation. This is not a feeling. It's not like the hunger in your belly when you need some food. It's not like becoming angry because somebody kicked you. That's one of my pet peeves. I used to, when I first began teaching about natural law years ago, and I was only beginning to learn about it myself, I was astonished because when I would speak to my students or to other groups about conscience, they immediately leapt to the assumption that I was talking about just how you feel.
Mm-hmm.
And they would tell me things like, well, you know, I thought I had some anxiety about doing this, but I felt okay about it in my conscience after a while.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, no, this isn't a matter of feeling. This is a judgment that we're making.
So a conscience – so I think Thomas was really specific, right? I mean, a conscience is a judgment of reason. That's how moral decisions are actually made.
This is something intellectual. Made. That's absolutely
okay.
Right.
Okay.
Both of these things are. Synderesis, or deep conscience, is a natural – habitus, he says, a natural habit, a natural disposition of the mind, and conscientia is the actualization of that knowledge by the intellect. It's in the act of judgment. So these are intellectual functions. These are things that the mind is doing. This isn't, as somebody's put it, a quiver in the liver.
We have, it seems to me, in our culture, we have a lot of heavy lifting to do then to form our conscience rightly, because we have a lot of conflicting authorities, including nowadays, you know, me, myself, the post-Nietzschean man as an authority, me and my will to power and my desires and everything, all these conflicting authorities.
The funny thing here is, we've cast off the very idea that we should have any authority. Now, you can't do that because the individual all by himself doesn't have enough resources to make all of his decisions. So when you think that you're casting off all authority, what you're actually doing is that you're inventing bogus authorities. And that's why there are so many of them and they come into conflict.
Hmm. So let's be practical then. So let's say I'm a Catholic American, which I actually am, so this is easy to pretend. Let's say I'm a Catholic American, and I really want to form my conscience rightly in terms of what you've been describing and St. Thomas Aquinas would describe in the Catechism of the Catholic Church. And I know that certain things are wrong, and I don't know if I know it because I've been taught or because I heard it growing up and I heard it in CCD, or I just have this kind of a sense that I can't describe. But I'm not the kind of person who's going to sit down and read the Summa Theologica, and I'm not the kind of person who's going to read works on synderesis and that kind of thing. What can I do to make sure that the things I think are good that I'm doing, and the laws I think that I'm obeying or not obeying, that I'm doing the right thing?
Well, I think one good thing is to reflect on divine law. It isn't as though God has just sort of left us in the dark without any clues about whether it is wrong to deliberately take innocent human life, or whether we ought to honor our parents, or whether we ought to steal. Another good thing that's helpful to remember is that those big-ticket items that are mentioned, for instance, in the Ten Commandments, those are... This is often overlooked. They aren't when the Ten Commandments, for instance, says be faithful to your spouse. That doesn't mean now you can practice any form of sexual impurity you want to, as long as you don't practice that. As long as you don't practice the form of impurity of being unfaithful to your spouse. No, it means don't practice sexual impurity. And the way we're reminding you is taking the worst form of it here as the example that gets into the commandment. Similarly, when it says don't bear false witness, that doesn't mean you can lie in other ways. Just don't lie to get people. Just don't give testimony to get people into trouble. That's dishonest. No, it doesn't mean that. It means don't lie at all. But this commandment picks out the worst form of lying to get the point across. Do you see what I mean? Mm-hmm. All of these commandments, these things that are prohibited, are the placeholders. They're the worst examples, but they stand for a lot of other things. Honor your parents really includes an awful lot of other things too, I think, like having respect for all of our forebears, for all of those generations that labored to make it possible for us to come into being.
And maybe respect for authority, perhaps?
Well, and even respect for legitimate authority, mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think that reflecting on these things, just meditating on them, taking some time. You don't have to be a scholar who's reading the Summa Theologiae, but you can reflect on this. This was intended for ordinary people, and listen and think about it in interior silence. That might mean unplugging the iPad and pulling the pods out of your ears and just thinking about things in silence. It also means reflecting on our examples, the disciplines of the sacramental life, of regular confession and so forth, examination of conscience. These are going to help us. The other disciplines, even right now, this is Lent, the disciplines of Lent, thinking, what are the obstacles in my life and getting rid of them? My obstacles to temperance, or my obstacles to keeping my temper? How can I eliminate these things and discipline myself? Those disciplines are going to improve our moral judgment too. A person who is temperate, who is going to make better, he's not just going to be less likely to make a pig of himself eating, but he's going to make better judgments about the whole matter of food and pleasures and intake. Okay, I think what else can we do? We can meditate on, we can think about the lives of the great heroes of the faith, the heroes of virtue, of the past, and why their lives were so good, and try to model ourselves on that. We can feast our minds and our imaginations and our hearts on the stories of them, some of them told in the Bible, some of them in Christian tradition. All of these things are good for us. There are a lot of crummy novels out there that will have bad influences on us, but there's an awful lot of really wonderful literature that sharpens our ability to think about these things and gives greater sharpness and acuity and depth and beauty to our reflections on these things also. So by choosing good literature and exposing yourself to good things and not exposing yourself to bad things, that helps.
So I think there are a
lot of things that we can do. I don't think that we all have to be scholars.
But ultimately we're talking about building those habits of virtue then, which would lead to
discipline, right? Yeah. The discipline of virtue. You know, we hate to use the word discipline today, don't we?
Well, we want it easy, and unless people are different than I am, you know, easy seems better, right? But there's certain things that require discipline, and living well and living the good life is one of them.
Sure, and that discipline is a joy. You know, in the end, it is. This is true even in things that don't have anything much to do with the moral life. For instance, a painter, in order to make beautiful paintings, has to submit to the discipline of the properties of the paint and the properties of the canvas and the properties of color and the properties of laws of composition, or he's just going to make a mess. It's not going to be beautiful. That discipline then is actually liberating because it makes it possible for him to make things of beauty. It's not something that holds him back. A musician has to submit to the discipline until it's second nature of rhythm and of harmony, of chordal structure, and because otherwise he'll only make noise, he won't really make music. But that's what it does. It liberates you to make that music. So the paradox here is that authentic liberty, mm-hmm. the ability to be what God created us to be, to live in alignment with what we most fundamentally are, which is the image of God, that liberty depends on discipline rather than being opposed by proper discipline.
So this is exactly then what Edmund Burke meant by liberty must be limited to be possessed. I mean, in that sense. And I talk about Burke so much to my students and talk about liberty and order and the balance of the two and virtue and these many things. But I think you've clarified for me more than ever before what that really means in practical terms. I love your that's a feeling. I love the when you talk about musicians and painters, and I hadn't quite thought of discipline in that sense. And now look what you're free to do. I mean, think even especially of writing and the grammar and proper diction, etc., and use of words that are required to communicate fully to people and clearly.
And if we keep it up, or dancing, you know, think one has the impression, looking at a ballerina who really knows her craft, one has the impression that it's effortless. Mm-hmm. But why does it look effortless? It looks effortless because she has expended such effort in the disciplines of doing this until it has become second nature. And that's what we have to do.
I recall an interview recently that I read with a fairly famous rock musician, and he said kids, meaning, you know, teenagers, people in their 20s would come up to him all the time, and they have a band and they want to be famous, and he said that once he tells them that it took, 7-day weeks for 15 years before he even had his first hit or something, and it was a lot of work, tremendous amount of work, he said that they almost always leave crestfallen because they think if you're awesome, how can you not be instantly famous and a well-known musician, et cetera? But
isn't that ironic? That this truth of the necessity of discipline in order to do something is true even in rock and roll
music.
Exactly.
This is these are the people who are supposed to.
A hedonistic message that says you don't need discipline.
Yeah. You're supposed to throw, you throw your furniture out the hotel window. You're in a party culture. You have these self-indulgent 25-minute guitar solos or something. And this really, that also takes work. And well, it sure does. So actual dancing, as you said, also takes work. It's more than just simply gyrating around, right?
That's right. At least if it's going to be beautiful.
If it's going to be beautiful. Sure.
You mentioned writing. It's the same thing. You know, I noticed that now some of my students are actually pretty good writers, but many of them are bad writers. Now why? It's partly because they haven't, first of all, submitted to the discipline of reading.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And learned the rhythms, the sound, the interior music of the English language, of how it rolls and how it doesn't. and so that they don't put that into their writing. You have to submit to these, to all of these things. It's language has a music too, and it's something that has to be learned.
That's a good point. It reminds me of the coach of the Tennessee Volunteers in the 1990s, Philip Fulmer, used to make his, you know, three to, and maybe I'm exaggerating, I don't know, but 300 to 400 pound linesmen, they would go through ballet lessons.
I heard that. I've heard that. Yes.
And that's probably, maybe that's common in football, but it's first off, it's very hard to imagine. And then secondly, you can see what that would do. It's a matter of disciplining them and giving them precision. And if there's one thing I would say, if you talk about improving all of our writing and student writing, it's precision. It's concision.
Precision.
And
precision is a kind of a discipline too. Mm-hmm. To learn the discipline of saying what you mean and not saying some close cousin.
Well, we've had a far-reaching conversation here over about the past hour. We started off with Professor Budziszewski talking about law and Thomas Aquinas on law, because his new book by Cambridge University Press is a commentary on Thomas Aquinas' treatise on law. Professor, is that book part of a series from Cambridge of commentaries, or was that kind of a standalone book that you've been wanting to do for a long time?
No, it's a standalone book. It's although I am intending to extend it and to write some commentaries on other sections.
Okay, we would look forward to that.
And I can tell our listeners that if they want to find out more about it, and if they even want to, there's one part of it that's free and online and downloadable. It's like a whole second book that goes along with the print book. It's called The Companion to the Commentary, and they can link to that at my own website, and they can find out more about the commentary too at my website. That's at www.undergroundthomist.org.
One last thing before we let you go. Why Underground Thomist? Is this because you're not at a Catholic college like myself, or?
Well,
why?
That's right. I mean, I'm out here in the the neo-pagan land. The modern university is it thinks that it has no established religion, but in fact it does have an unofficially established religion, which is not theoretical atheism. You're not required to believe that there's no God, but it's operational atheism. You are expected to live as though, even if there is a God, he couldn't make a difference to anything, and he certainly couldn't make a difference to your learning or the function of your mind.
Yeah, and you have to approach truth as if there is no unity of truth, and that maybe it can't even know the truth. There's so many things that go along with the multiversity, as some have called it.
That's right.
Do violence.
The university was a Christian invention of the Middle Ages. It didn't have its origin in Plato's Academy, as many people think. It had its origin in Christian intellectual culture in the Middle Ages, and that's when people believed in that there was a possibility of universal truth, because all of the truth of the universe came from the one mind of God. But most people in our modern universities, so-called universities, don't believe that any longer. So they aren't universities now. That's why they're multiversities or chaosiversities.
Chaosiversity, even better term. I'll be using that now for a while. And, you know, it's a struggle even at Catholic colleges and universities. That's no surprise to any of our listeners. The drive to be respectable means to adopt secular ways without knowing, of course, the unintended consequences that would have for seeking truth, et cetera. But this is a whole other conversation here, and we should thank you very much for being on Faith and Reason today. And again, at Underground Thomas, you can find out a lot more about Mr. Budziszewski's works and his new book from Cambridge University Press, his commentary on Aquinas' treatise on law. I want to thank you very much for being on the program today.
You're welcome. It's been my pleasure.
And thank you, listeners, for tuning in to Faith and Reason here on Holy Family Radio, Grand Rapids, Kalamazoo, Battle Creek. I want to wish you the best. Bye-bye.
You've been been listening to Faith and Reason with your host, Dr. John Pinero, on Holy Family Radio. If you'd like to listen to this program again or share it with a friend, audio copies are available online at holyfamilyradio.net. Dr. John Pinero is Professor of History and Director of Catholic Studies at Aquinas College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Faith and Reason is brought to you by Holy Family Radio. I'm your program producer, Michael Fiorenzo. Join us next time as we connect the riches of the Catholic intellectual tradition to daily life. Thanks for listening.